Hello, this is Ed Reedy from the Talking Information Center with today's reading from Reuters. U.S. freezes five big offshore wind projects. Shares dive. The Trump administration suspended leases on Monday for five large offshore wind projects that are under construction off the U.S. East Coast over what it called national security concerns, sending shares of offshore wind companies plunging. The suspension was the latest blow for offshore wind developers that have faced repeated disruptions to their multi-billion-dollar projects under U.S. President Donald Trump, who has said he finds wind turbines ugly, costly, and inefficient. State officials, Democratic lawmakers, offshore wind companies, and industry trade groups slammed the move as unjustified. U.S. Department of the Interior said the decision was the result of complaints by the Pentagon that the movement of huge turbine blades for offshore wind projects, as well as the highly reflective towers that hold them up, cause radar interference that can make it hard to identify and locate security threats. The pause will give relevant federal agencies time to work with leaseholders and state partners to assess the possibility of mitigating the national security risks posed by these projects, the department said in a statement. The prime duty of the United States government is to protect the American people, Secretary of the Interior Doug Burgum said in the statement. States consider their options. The pause will affect Danish energy firm Ørsted's Revolution Wind and Sunrise Wind projects, Avangrid and Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners' Vineyard Wind project, Dominion Energy's Coastal Virginia Offshore Wind, and Equinor's Empire Wind 1 project, according to the statement. Shares in Ørsted traded down more than 12%, with Domino and Equinor also trading lower. Domino said the suspension will threaten grid reliability for its Virginia customers, including military bases and data centers powering international intelligence. These electrons will power the data centers that will win the AI race, support our warfighters, and build the nuclear warships needed to maintain our maritime supremacy, the company said. Ørsted said its projects were in advanced stages and have been preparing to power around 1 million homes across three states from next year. Ørsted is evaluating all options to resolve the matter expeditiously together with its partners, the company said. Equinor said it was also evaluating the suspension. Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners was not immediately available for comment. New York Governor Kathy Hochul and Connecticut Attorney General William Tong said in separate statements on Monday that states affected by the freeze were reviewing their options. The Trump administration will look for any excuse to continue its assault on clean energy and the thousands of good-paying jobs these projects bring, but there is no credible justification for this stoppage, Hochul said. The National Ocean Industries Association, a trade group representing offshore wind developers, urged the administration to end the pause quickly, pointing out that the Pentagon had been involved in approving the projects under past administrations. The regulatory process involves a rigorous framework for assessing the national security implications of proposed projects, and every project under construction has already undergone review by the Department of Defense with no objections, NOIA President Eric Melito said. The top Democrats leading the Senate's Environment and Energy Committees said they would not back a bipartisan permitting reform effort in 2026 unless the administration backs off the offshore wind halt. The illegal attacks on fully permitted renewable energy projects must be reversed if there is to be any chance that permitting talks resume, said Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and New Mexico Senator Martin Heinrich in a joint statement. Trump's anti-wind industry stance. In August, the administration had ordered Ørsted to halt already advanced construction on the Revolution Wind project off Rhode Island, though a federal judge later lifted the ban. Earlier in the year, the administration lifted a stop work order on Equinor's Empire Wind in a compromise with New York State that paved the way for a natural gas pipeline Trump supports. Trump campaigned for the White House on a promise to end the offshore wind industry, saying windmills are too expensive and hurt whales and birds, while promoting oil and gas. The uncertainty has taken a financial toll on developers. Ørsted raised $9.4 billion early this year to help fund U.S. projects after potential partners were deterred by Trump's hostility to wind power. Interior Secretary Burgum has previously said the administration is concerned that offshore wind installations can make the United States more vulnerable to attacks by swarms of drones. Exclusive, China likely loaded more than 100 ICBMs in silo fields, Pentagon report says, by Idris Ali. Washington. China is likely to have loaded more than 100 intercontinental ballistic missiles across its latest three silo fields and has no desire for arms control talks, according to a draft Pentagon report which highlighted Beijing's growing military ambitions. China is expanding and modernizing its weapons stockpile faster than any other nuclear-armed power, according to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, a Chicago-based nonprofit. Beijing has described reports of a military buildup as efforts to smear and defame China and deliberately mislead the international community. Last month, U.S. President Donald Trump said that he may be working on a plan to denuclearize with China and Russia, but the draft Pentagon report, which was seen by Reuters, said Beijing did not appear to be interested. We continue to see no appetite from Beijing for pursuing such measures or more comprehensive arms control discussions, the report said. In particular, the report said that China had likely put in more than 100 solid-fuel DF-31 ICBMs in silo fields close to China's border with Mongolia, the latest in a series of silo sites. The Pentagon had previously reported the existence of the fields, but not the number of missiles loaded. The Pentagon declined to comment. China's embassy in Washington, D.C. said China has maintained a defensive nuclear strategy, kept its officials noted. Kept its nuclear forces at the minimum level required for national security and abided by its commitment to a moratorium on nuclear testing. The draft Pentagon report did not identify any potential target of the reported newly placed missiles. U.S. officials noted that the report could change before it was sent to lawmakers. The report said China's nuclear warhead stockpile was still in the low 600s in 2024, which reflected a slower rate of production when compared to previous years. But the report added that China's nuclear expansion was ongoing, and it was on track to have over 1,000 warheads by 2030. China has said it adheres to a nuclear strategy of self-defense and prefers a no-first-use policy. Trump has said he wants the United States to resume nuclear weapons testing, but it is unclear what form that will take. Former U.S. President Joe Biden and Trump, during his first term, sought to engage China and Russia in negotiations on replacing New START with three-way strategic nuclear arms control treaty. The wide-ranging Pentagon report detailed China's military buildup and said that China expects to be able to fight and win a war on Taiwan by the end of 2027. China, which views democratically governed Taiwan as its own territory, has never renounced use of force to reunify with the island. Beijing was refining its military options to take Taiwan by brute force, the report said, adding that one option could include strikes 1,500 to 2,000 nautical miles from China. In sufficient volume, these strikes could seriously challenge and disrupt U.S. presence in or around a conflict in the Asia-Pacific region, it added. The report comes less than 2 months before the expiration of the 2010 New START Treaty, the last U.S.-Russia nuclear arms control accord, which limits the sides to deploying 1,550 strategic nuclear warheads on 700 delivery systems. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Biden extended the pact for 5 years in February 2021, but its terms do not allow for a further formal extension. Many experts fear that the expiration of the pact could fuel a three-way nuclear arms race. More nuclear weapons and an absence of diplomacy will not make anyone safer, neither China, Russia, or the United States, said Daryl Kimball, executive director of the Arms Control Association Advocacy Group. Anti-corruption purges. Chinese President Xi Jinping has undertaken a broad corruption crackdown, with the People's Liberation Army, PLA, being one of the main targets. The report said that the purge could impact short-term nuclear readiness, but also set the stage for long-term PLA improvements overall. Revenues at China's giant military firms fell last year as corruption purges slowed arms contracts and procurement, according to a leading conflict think tank. China's weapons revenue fell despite 3 decades of rising defense budgets in Beijing's growing strategic rivalry with the United States. Asia's traditional military power and tensions over Taiwan and the hotly disputed South China Sea. In the past 18 months, at least 26 top and former managers in state-owned arms companies have been investigated or removed from their positions, the Pentagon report said. Investigations have expanded from a 2023 focus on procurement of rockets and missiles industry to most of China's defense industry, including China's nuclear and shipbuilding industry, it added. Exclusive U.S. conducting surveillance flights over Nigeria after Trump intervention threat, by Jessica Donati and Idris Ailey. The U.S. has been conducting intelligence gathering flights over large parts of Nigeria since late November, according to flight tracking data and current and former U.S. officials, in a sign of increased security cooperation between the countries. Reuters could not determine what information the flights are meant to obtain, but the flights in West Africa follow U.S. President Donald Trump's threats in November to militarily intervene in Nigeria over what he says is its failure to stop violence targeting Christian communities. The flights also are occurring just months after a U.S. pilot working for a missionary agency was kidnapped in neighboring Niger. The U.S. contractor-operated aircraft used for the surveillance operations typically takes off from Ghana and flies over Nigeria before returning to Accra, the Ghanaian capital, the tracking data for December shows. Flight tracking data shows the operator is Mississippi-based 10X Aerospace, which provides special mission aircraft and works closely with the U.S. military, according to the company's website. 10X Aerospace did not respond to a request for comment. Liam Carr, the African team lead for the Critical Threats Project at the American Enterprise Institute, has analyzed the flight data. He said the operation appeared to be running out of an airport in Accra, a known hub for the U.S. military's logistics network in Africa. Carr said the operation was an early sign the U.S. was rebuilding its capacity in the region after Niger ordered U.S. troops to leave a sprawling newly built airbase in the desert last year and turned instead to Russia for security assistance. In recent weeks, we've seen a resumption of intelligence and surveillance flights in Nigeria, Carr said in an interview. A former U.S. official said the aircraft is among several assets the Trump administration moved to Ghana in November. It is unclear how many aircraft remain in Ghana, but the former official said the missions include tracking down the kidnapped U.S. pilot and gathering intelligence on militant groups operating in Nigeria. Boko Haram and its splinter organization, Islamic State West Africa Province, are among the militant groups operating in Nigeria. A current U.S. official confirmed the aircraft has been flying over Nigeria, but declined to provide details given the diplomatic sensitivity of the issue. A separate administration official said Washington was continuing to work with Nigeria to address religious violence, anti-Christian attacks, and the destabilizing spread of terrorism. The former U.S. official and the current administration officials all spoke on condition of anonymity. In a statement, the Pentagon said the U.S. government held productive meetings with Nigeria following Trump's message about the country, but declined to discuss intelligence matters. Nigeria's military spokesperson did not respond to requests for comment. Ghana's deputy defense minister also did not respond to a request for comment. Daily surveillance flights, Nigeria's government has said armed groups target both Muslims and Christians, and the U.S. claims that Christians face persecution do not represent a complex security situation and ignore efforts to safeguard religious freedoms. But it has agreed to work with the U.S. to bolster its forces against militant groups. The country's population is split between Muslims living primarily in the north and Christians in the south. A Nigerian security source, speaking on condition of anonymity, said the U.S. agreed in a November 20th meeting between Nigerian National Security Advisor Nuhu Ribadu and U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to deploy air assets to gather intelligence. A spokesperson for the Nigerian military did not respond to requests for comment. The Tenax aerospace aircraft was seen on November 7th by flight tracking data at MacDill Air Force Base, which is the home to the headquarters of the United States Special Operations Command in Tampa, Florida. It flew to Ghana on November 24, just days after the high-level meeting between U.S. and Nigerian security officials, according to flight tracking data. The data shows the aircraft has flown over Nigeria almost daily since the start of the operation. The aircraft is a Gulfstream V, a long-range business jet often modified for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance missions, according to the data. Security emergency in Nigeria. Nigeria's president, Bola Tinubu, declared a security emergency last month and ordered the army and police to begin mass recruitment to tackle worsening armed violence across the country. That move followed attacks in multiple Nigerian states where civilians were killed and kidnapped, and the mass abduction of more than 300 schoolchildren in northern Nigeria. The U.S., meanwhile, has taken steps to punish Nigeria for its perceived failure to protect Christians. In October, Trump added Nigeria back onto a list of countries that the U.S. says have violated religious freedom. This week, Nigeria was added to the U.S. travel ban list of countries facing partial restrictions and entry limitations. Trump has also asked the Defense Department to prepare for possible fast military action in Nigeria if the West African nation fails to crack down on the killing of Christians. The U.S. and Nigeria have established a joint task force to work on security, according to Republican U.S. Representative Riley Moore, who recently traveled to the African country. Trump says U.S. needs Greenland for security. Taps envoy to lead the charge, by Steve Holland. Palm Beach, Florida, and Copenhagen. President Donald Trump reasserted on Monday that the United States needs Greenland for its national security and said a special envoy he appointed to the Arctic island would lead the charge. Trump named Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry on Sunday as his special envoy to Greenland, drawing renewed criticism from Denmark and Greenland over Washington's interest in the mineral-rich Arctic island. Trump has advocated for Greenland, a self-governing Danish territory, to become part of the United States, citing its strategic importance and mineral resources. Landry, who took office as governor in January 2024, publicly supports the idea. We need Greenland for national security, not for minerals. If you take a look at Greenland, you look them down the coast, you have Russian and Chinese ships all over the place. We need it for national security. We have to have it, Trump told reporters in Palm Beach, Florida, adding that Landry wanted to lead the charge. Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen and Greenland's Prime Minister Jens Frederik Nielsen earlier said in a joint statement that Greenland belongs to Greenlanders. You cannot annex another country, not even with an argument about international security, they said. Greenland belongs to the Greenlanders, and the U.S. shall not take over Greenland. Landry, in a post on X, thanked Trump. It's an honor to serve in this voluntary position to make Greenland a part of the U.S. This in no way affects my position as governor of Louisiana. The Trump administration put further pressure on Copenhagen on Monday when it suspended leases for five large offshore wind projects being built off the east coast of the U.S., including two being developed by Denmark's state-controlled Ørsted. Greenland, a former Danish colony with a population of about 57,000, has the right to declare independence under a 2009 agreement, but remains heavily reliant on fishing and Danish subsidies. Its strategic position between Europe and North America makes it a key site for the U.S. ballistic missile defense system. While its mineral wealth has heightened U.S. interest in reducing reliance on Chinese exports, after Trump made the appointment on Sunday, Greenland's Nielsen commented on Facebook, "We have woken up again to a new announcement from the U.S. president. This may sound big, but it does not change anything for us. We decide our future." Diplomatic tensions escalate. Danish Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen said on Monday he would summon U.S. Ambassador Kenneth Howery, who had pledged mutual respect during a recent visit to Greenland. Out of nowhere, there is now a special U.S. presidential representative who, according to himself, is tasked with taking over Greenland. "This is, of course, completely unacceptable," Rasmussen told TV2. Denmark has sought to repair strained ties with Greenland over the past year, while also trying to ease tensions with the Trump administration by investing in Arctic defense to address U.S. criticism about inadequate security. "It is a difficult situation that our allies for a lifetime are putting us in," Prime Minister Frederiksen said in an Instagram post. Mikkel Vedby Rasmussen, a political science professor at the University of Copenhagen, told Reuters, "This appointment shows that all the money Denmark has invested in Greenland, in the defense of the Arctic, and all the friendly things we have said to the Americans have had no effect at all." Novo Nordisk wins U.S. approval for weight loss pill by Maggie Fick and Mariam E. Sunny. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved Novo Nordisk's weight loss pill on Monday, giving the Danish drug maker a leg up in the race to market a potent oral medication for shedding pounds as it looks to regain lost ground from rival Eli Lilly. The pill is 25 milligrams of semaglutide, the same active ingredient in injectable Wegovy and Ozempic, and will be sold under the brand name Wegovy. Novo already sells an oral semaglutide for type 2 diabetes, Rybelsus. The approval could help spur a turnaround for Novo after a rocky year of sliding shares, profit warnings, and slowing sales of its injectable Wegovy amid intense competition from Lilly and pressure from compounded versions. U.S.-listed shares of Novo jumped 8% and Lilly fell 1% in extended trading after the approval announcement. A 64-week stage study showed participants who took 25 milligrams of oral semaglutide once daily lost an average of 16.6% of their body weight, compared with 2.7% for those on a placebo. The bill was approved for chronic weight management in adults with obesity or overweight and at least one related health condition, broadening the potential patient pool at a time when insurers, employers, and governments are wrestling with spiraling healthcare costs related to obesity. It could help open the door to tens of millions of untapped patients in a global market forecast to be worth some $150 billion a year by the next decade. You're going to see a huge uptake in the patient base as new indications open up and as oral versions hit the market, said Anand Lar, chief AI officer at telehealth firm WellDoc. Novo is banking on the pill's first-to-market advantage to revitalize sales in the U.S., where it has lost ground to Lilly. Lilly's next-generation weight loss pill, orforglipron, could be approved as soon as late March. David Moore, Novo's executive vice president of U.S. operations, said a daily pill could boost interest and uptake of the drug. Novo is manufacturing the pill in the United States in North Carolina and has been building up supplies of the pill for some time to ensure that it has ample supply, he said. Some 40% of American adults are obese, U.S. government data shows, and around 12% say they currently take GLP-1 drugs, according to a poll published last month by health policy research organization KFF. Novo had the first-to-market advantage with injectables, but initially struggled to meet explosive demand. Eventually, Lilly got ahead with its rival Zepbound, which now leads for weekly U.S. prescriptions. Novo and analysts say a weight loss pill would address injection hesitancy and expand access. Analysts say pills could capture around a one-fifth share of the market by 2030, particularly among patients who prefer simpler and less invasive treatment options. The pills will not displace or replace the injections, said Christopher Chrisman, managing director and partner at consultancy BCG, adding some patients may prefer to continue with weekly injections. But pills offer clear advantages to some people. There's travel convenience and no need for a fridge, he added. Novo said the 1.5 milligram starting dose of the Wegovy pill will be available in early January. Novo and Lilly had agreed to offer starter doses of their weight loss pills at $149 per month for the U.S. government Medicare and Medicaid health insurance programs, and to cash-paying customers via the White House's direct-to-consumer Trump RX site. Novo recently cut the cash price for Wegovy to $349 a month from $499. U.S. list prices are about $1,000 per month or more. Novo CEO Mike Doustdar said in November that people using weight loss drugs show more consumer-like behavior than its traditional diabetes patients, acknowledging that the company needs to adapt to this and bring in new expertise. Whether another semaglutide product can solve Novo's current ills remains to be seen. Novo's oral semaglutide needs to be taken in the morning on an empty stomach, 30 minutes before eating, drinking, or using any other oral medication. Lilly's pill does not have those restrictions. Oil slips as market weighs Venezuela-Russia supply risks. Oil prices eased in early trade on Tuesday after rising more than 2% in the previous session as the U.S. said it might sell Venezuelan crude it has seized, while Ukraine's attacks on Russian vessels and piers heightened supply disruption fears. Brent crude futures fell 11 cents to $61.96 per barrel. U.S. West Texas Intermediate crude lost 13 cents, or 0.22%, to $57.88. Both benchmarks settled more than 2% higher in the previous session, with Brent posting its best daily performance in 2 months and WTI climbing the most since November 14. In his pressure campaign on Venezuela, which includes a blockade on oil tankers under sanctions entering and leaving the country, U.S. President Donald Trump on Monday said the U.S. might keep or sell the oil it had seized off the coast of Venezuela in recent weeks. "Maybe we sell it, maybe we keep it," Trump said, adding it might also be used to replenish the United States' strategic reserves. He also said it would be smart for Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to leave power. It is true that even if Venezuelan oil exports were to fall to zero over the near term, oil markets will likely still be well supplied in H1-26, Barclays said in a note dated Monday. However, Barclays estimates the global oil surplus will shrink to just 700,000 barrels per day in the fourth quarter of 2026, and a prolonged disruption could tighten the market further, depleting recent inventory builds. Meanwhile, Russia and Ukraine waged attacks on each other's facilities on the Black Sea, a vital export route for both countries. Russian forces struck Ukraine's Black Sea port of Odessa late on Monday and damaged port facilities and a ship in the second attack on the region in less than 24 hours. A Ukrainian drone attack damaged two vessels, two piers, and sparked a fire in a village in Russia's Krasnodar region, regional authorities said on Monday. Ukraine has also targeted Russia's maritime logistics, focusing on shadow fleet oil tankers that attempt to bypass sanctions on Russia over the nearly four-year war. The market remains cautious as traders weigh geopolitical risks against forecasts of ample supply in early 2026, leaving prices potentially sensitive to any prolonged disruptions. "Car bomb kills Russian general in Moscow," investigators say, by Reuters. Moscow, a Russian general, was killed by a car bomb in southern Moscow on Monday, Russian investigators said, adding that they suspected Ukrainian special services could have been behind the attack. The bomb exploded under the Kia Sorento car driven by Lieutenant General Finil Savarovov, head of the Russian General Staff Army Operational Training Directorate, as he left a parking space at 6:55 Moscow time. Russia's State Investigative Committee said Savarov had died from his injuries. It published video of the wrecked vehicle with blood visible on the driver's seat and one of the doors blown off. Svetlana Petrenko, a spokesperson for the committee, said investigators were gathering forensic evidence, questioning witnesses, and reviewing security camera footage. Various versions of the killing are being examined, one of which involves the possible role of Ukrainian intelligence services in organizing the crime, she said. There was no official comment from Ukraine. Mira Tarveritz, an unofficial Ukrainian website that provides a database of people described as war criminals or traitors, updated its entry on Savarov to say the 56-year-old had been liquidated. A string of Russian military figures and high-profile supporters of Moscow's war in Ukraine have been assassinated during the nearly four-year-old conflict, and Ukrainian military intelligence has said it was responsible for a number of the attacks. Among those killed in previous car bombings in or near Moscow were a senior member of the General Staff, the chief of Russia's nuclear, biological, and chemical protection troops, and the daughter of a prominent Russian nationalist figure. Interfax news agency quoted Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov as saying President Vladimir Putin had been instantly informed of the attack on Savarov. Japan prepares to restart world's biggest nuclear plant 15 years after Fukushima, by Kantora Komilia, Katya Kolobakova, and Yuka Obasha. Niigata, Japan. Japan took the final step to allow the world's largest nuclear power plant to resume operations with a regional vote on Monday, a watershed moment in the country's return to nuclear energy nearly 15 years after the Fukushima disaster. Kashiwazaki Kariwa, located about 220 kilometers, 136 miles, northwest of Tokyo, was among 54 reactors shut after the 2011 earthquake and tsunami crippled the Fukushima Daiichi plant in the worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl. Since then, Japan has restarted 14 of the 33 that remain operable as it tries to wean itself off imported fossil fuels. Kashiwazaki Kariwa will be the first operated by Tokyo Electric Power, which ran the doomed Fukushima plant. On Monday, Niigata Prefecture's assembly passed a vote of confidence on Niigata Governor Hideo Hanazumi, who backed the restart last month, effectively allowing for the plant to begin operations again. "This is a milestone, but this is not the end," Hanazuma told reporters after the vote. "There is no end in terms of ensuring the safety of Niigata residents." While lawmakers voted in support of Hanazumi, the assembly session, the last for the year, exposed the community's divisions over the restart, despite new jobs and potentially lower electricity bills. "This is nothing other than a political settlement that does not take into account the will of the Niigata residents," an assembly member opposed to the restart told fellow lawmakers as the vote was about to begin. Outside, around 300 protesters stood in the cold, holding banners reading, "No nukes. We oppose the restart of Kashiwazaki Kariwa and support Fukushima. I am truly angry from the bottom of my heart," Kenichiro Ishiyama, a 77-year-old protester from Niigata City, told Reuters after the vote. "If something was to happen at that plant, we would be the ones to suffer the consequences." TEPCO is considering reactivating the first of 7 reactors at the plant on January 20th, public broadcaster NHK reported. Kashiwazaki Kariwa's total capacity is 8.2 gigawatts, enough to power a few million homes. The pending restart would bring 1.36 kilowatt unit online next year, start another one with the same capacity around 2030. "We remain firmly committed to never repeating such an accident and ensuring Niigata residents never experience anything similar," said TEPCO spokesperson Masakatsu Takada. Takada declined to comment on timing. TEPCO shares closed up 2% in the afternoon trade in Tokyo, higher than the wider Nikkei index, which was up 1.8%. Reluctant residents wary of restart. TEPCO earlier this year pledged to inject 100 billion yen, $641 million, into the prefecture over the next 10 years as it sought to win the support of Niigata residents. But a survey published by the prefecture in October found 60% of residents did not think conditions for the restart had been met. Nearly 70% were worried about TEPCO operating the plant. Ayakawa Oga, 52, settled in Niigata after fleeing the area around the Fukushima plant in 2011 with 160,000 other evacuees. Her old home was inside the 20-kilometer irradiated exclusion zone. The farmer and anti-nuclear activist has joined the Niigata protests. "We know firsthand the risk of nuclear accident and cannot dismiss it," said Oga, adding that she still struggles with post-traumatic stress-like symptoms from what happened to Fukushima. Even Niigata Governor Hanazumi hopes that Japan will eventually be able to reduce its reliance on nuclear power. "I want to see an era where we don't have to rely on energy sources that cause anxiety," he said last month. strengthening energy security, the Monday vote was seen as the final hurdle before TEPCO restarts the first reactor, which alone could boost electricity supply to the Tokyo area by 2%, Japan's trade ministry has estimated. Prime Minister Sonia Takasia, who took office 2 months ago, has backed nuclear restarts to strengthen energy security and to counter the cost of imported fossil fuels, which account for 60 to 70% of Japan's electricity generation. Japan spent 10.7 trillion yen, $68 billion, last year on imported liquefied natural gas and coal, a tenth of its total import costs. Despite its shrinking population, Japan expects energy demand to rise over the coming decade due to a boom in power-hungry AI data centers. To meet those needs and its decarbonization commitments, it has set a target of doubling the share of nuclear power in its electricity mix to 20% by 2040. Joshua Nugu, Vice Chairman for Asia Pacific at the consultancy Wood Mackenzie, said public acceptance of the restart at Kashiwake Kariwae would represent a critical milestone toward reaching those goals. In July, Kansai Electric Power, Japan's top nuclear power operator, said it would begin conducting surveys for a reactor in western Japan, the first new unit since Fukushima's disaster. But for Oga, who was in the crowd outside the assembly on Monday chanting, "Never forget Fukushima's lessons," the nuclear revival is a terrifying reminder of the potential risks. "At the time, 2011, I never thought that TEPCO would operate a nuclear power plant again," she said. "As a victim of the Fukushima nuclear accident, I wish that no one, whether in Japan or anywhere in the world, ever again suffers the damage of a nuclear accident." U.S. Heritage Foundation think tank staff quit amid anti-Semitism controversy, by Andrew Hay. Over a dozen employees have left jobs at the Heritage Foundation or were fired in recent days, according to the influential right-wing U.S. think tank, as it grapples with allegations from former supporters that it has aligned itself with those accused of anti-Semitism. In a statement about the resignations and firings on Monday, Heritage Foundation Chief Advancement Officer Andy Olivastoro said a handful of staff had chosen disruption and disloyalty. He said the think tank has always welcomed debate, but alignment on mission and loyalty to the institution are non-negotiable. The foundation has been caught in a firestorm of accusations and counter-accusations that began when former Fox News host Tucker Carlson interviewed Nick Fuentes, a self-described Christian nationalist, in October. The interview focused on their mutual opposition to U.S. support of Israel, a view at odds with that of many conservatives. Some supporters of the foundation have said it would distance itself from Carlson, characterizing the journalist's views as anti-Semitic. But Kevin Roberts, the foundation president, has continued to personally back Carlson, who he says is a friend. Carlson strongly rejects accusations of anti-Semitism. One of those who resigned this week was Josh Blackman, a law professor who contributed to Project 2025, a right-wing policy initiative overseen by the Heritage Foundation. In a letter posted online, he blamed Roberts for making Heritage brand toxic. "You aligned the Heritage Foundation with the rising tide of anti-Semitism on the right," said Blackman, who edited the group's Guide to the Constitution publication. In an October 30th video defending Carlson, Robert said a venomous coalition was attacking the prominent podcaster over his interview with Fuentes. Roberts said conservatives should feel no obligation to support any foreign government, no matter how great the pressure from the globalist class. He later apologized for his use of the term venomous coalition, which he said Jewish colleagues understood to be an anti-Semitic trope. Speaking at a November staff town hall meeting, Roberts said his intention was not to endorse Fuentes, who he called an evil person, but to convert some of his audience of several million people. Advancing American Freedom, said on Monday, the three former leaders of the Heritage's legal, economic, and data teams had joined the conservative advocacy group, along with 10 of their staff. The group, led by former Vice President Mike Pence, is critical of U.S. President Donald Trump's MAGA movement. Three Heritage Foundation board trustees have also resigned since November. Chief U.S. Circuit Judge William Pryor, a conservative jurist who contributed to Heritage's 800-page Guide to the Constitution, said in an interview he did not attend a promotional event for the book due to Roberts' totally inappropriate language in the October 30th video. For some remaining Heritage employees, recent staff departures were driven by Republican Party jockeying rather than anti-Semitism or Israel. These resignations have a lot more to do with 2028 than it does with anything else, Heritage fellow Robbie Starbuck posted online. One group wants to return to the Pence-Ryan GOP, and the rest want to MAGA with at Kevin Roberts TX. Pope Leo urges joyful, welcoming church in speech to Vatican cardinals, by Joshua McElwee. Vatican City, Pope Leo indicated on Monday that he plans to follow the reform agenda of his predecessor Francis, praising the late pontiff's attempts to make the global Catholic Church more inclusive in an annual Christmas address to Vatican cardinals. Leo, the first U.S. Pope, told the Church's senior-most officials that Francis, who died in April, had been a prophetic voice who strived to create a joyful church, welcoming to all and attentive to the poorest. Francis, who led the 1.4 billion-member church for 12 years, often used his annual Christmas speech with the cardinals to deliver blistering critiques of their work. In several lengthy speeches over the years, he listed what he called the illnesses and diseases of the Vatican's central bureaucracy, known as the Roman Curia. Leo, who has a more diplomatic style than his Argentine predecessor, spoke for only 15 minutes and offered no such rebukes. But he repeated many themes central to Francis's papacy. The Pope warned officials against falling into rigidity or ideology in enforcing Church's teaching and said the Vatican's complex structure must not weigh down or slow the progress of their work. He lamented that interpersonal conflicts sometimes mar Vatican operations. We observe with disappointment that certain dynamics linked to the exercise of power, the desire to prevail, or the pursuit of personal interests are slow to change, Leo said. We then ask ourselves, is it possible to be friends in the Roman Curia? Leo called for an ever more missionary Roman Curia in which institutions, offices, and tasks are conceived in light of today's major ecclesial, pastoral, and social changes, and not merely to ensure ordinary administration. Spot gold hits record high. Spot gold hit a record high in early Asia hours trades on Tuesday, propelled by rate cut bets, geopolitical and economic uncertainty, and central bank and ETF buying. The yellow metal hit a record high $4,445.69 per month. Powerball jackpot climbs to $1.6 billion, among the largest in U.S. history. The U.S. Powerball jackpot has climbed to an estimated $1.6 billion ahead of Monday night's drawing, cementing its place among the largest lottery prizes in American history. The jackpot swelled after Saturday's drawing produced no winners, allowing the payout to climb. The next drawing was set for 10:59 p.m. Eastern Time on Monday, with the odds of winning the jackpot 1 in 292.2 million. Players may choose between an annuitized payout of $1.6 billion over 29 years or a lump sum cash option of about $735.3 million before taxes, according to the lottery website. The jackpot is the fourth largest in Powerball history and the fifth largest among U.S. lottery jackpots. Several secondary prizes of $1 million were claimed in the most recent drawing. The largest Powerball jackpot ever was $2.04 billion, won in California in 2022, representing the largest U.S. lottery prize on record. Large jackpots tend to bolster ticket sales, boosting revenue for state lottery funds that support education and other public spending. 60 Minutes report on Salvadoran prison pulled from CBS, but appears to pop up online, by Siddharth Kaval and Helen Koster. New York, what appeared to be a 60-minute report on a Salvadoran mega-prison housing U.S. deported migrants spread online on Monday, a day after CBS News pulled the segment prior to its scheduled Sunday broadcast, saying it needed additional reporting. Reports from other news outlets indicated that the segment, which included allegations that Venezuelan deportees sent to the prison were tortured and raised questions about how the U.S. characterized them, had first streamed on Canada's Global TV app. Reuters reviewed an online video labeled as the segment in question and carrying the Global TV logo in the lower right-hand corner of the screen. Global TV normally streams new 60-minute episodes on Mondays, according to the app's website. A 60-minute spokesperson did not immediately respond to questions about the segment that apparently had been streamed and recorded by some viewers to be posted online. CBS abruptly pulled the segment hours before it was due to air on Sunday evening in the U.S., sparking accusations from inside 60 Minutes and on Capitol Hill that the network, owned by Paramount Skydance, was engaging in self-censorship under political pressure. The broadcast lineup for tonight's edition of 60 Minutes has been updated, the program posted on social media on Sunday, 3 hours before it was slated to air. Our report, Inside CECOT, will air in a future broadcast. Not an editorial decision, a CBS News spokesperson said in an email Sunday that the segment needed additional reporting. Sharon Alfonsi, a respondent who reported the segment, a correspondent who reported the segment, said in a note to her team that CBS pulled the report for political reasons, according to CBS News employee who confirmed the note's contents. Our story was screened 5 times and cleared by both CBS attorneys and standards and practices, Alfonsi wrote in the note. The CBS employee said on the condition of anonymity to avoid jeopardizing their position. It is factually correct, in my view, pulling it now, after every rigorous internal check has been met, is not an editorial decision, it is a political one. Alfonsi told the New York Times, which reported the note on Sunday evening, I refer all questions to Barry Weiss, referring to the new CBS News editor-in-chief. Neither Alfonsi nor Weiss responded to Reuters' request for comment. CECOT is a mega prison in El Salvador where the U.S. has sent hundreds of mostly Venezuelan migrants without trial. It has been condemned by human rights groups for its harsh conditions. Skydance Media, run by David Ellison, the son of longtime supporter of President Donald Trump, Larry Ellison, acquired Paramount in August. David Ellison helped secure regulatory approval for the deal with the promise that CBS Network would reflect the varied ideological perspectives of American viewers. Prior to the deal, Paramount paid $16 million to settle a 2024 lawsuit Trump filed over a 60 Minutes interview with former Vice President Kamala Harris, which he claimed gave a distorted view of his rival for the White House. The FCC has said the settlement and regulatory review were unrelated. On Monday, Ellison stepped in to personally guarantee $40.4 billion in Paramount Skydance's latest effort to pry Warner Brothers Discovery away from selling its prized Hollywood assets to streaming giant Netflix. It's unclear whether Weiss knew about the guarantee when she decided to hold the story. Earlier this month, Trump attacked the new owners of CBS over a 60-minute interview with his former ally, Republican U.S. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, on the same day Paramount Skydance launched a hostile bid for Warner Brothers Discovery. In an ex post Monday, Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer implied that the 60 Minutes postponement was politically motivated. Trump and his billionaire buddies are trying to shape what people see and hear to create their own alternative reality, Schumer wrote. The Trump administration doesn't have a veto on what stories get told. CBS should put the full, unedited version of this story on the air ASAP. A free press doesn't kowtow to the president. It holds him accountable. And that's all the time we have for today. Stay safe and thank you for listening.